And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Today we're going to talk to Thomas Mountain, a longtime friend who's based in Eritrea. And it's always been difficult to reach, but he's decided to go to Germany so we could get in this phone call, which is very kind of him. Actually, I had a note from him that he was traveling 110 miles per hour on the Autobahn. I hope he made it, because I don't like people texting me when they're doing that kind of thing. Anyway, this is, as I said, the Taylor Report. Today is July 4th, and it is, of course, a holiday in the United States, the Declaration of Independence. And I kind of an interesting footnote, particularly coming off the Democracy Now discussion about racism in the U.S. and the speech by Mr. Jesse Williams, terrific speech. This is the anniversary, too, of the tremendous victory at the Battle of Gettysburg, where American forces won their greatest victory against the traitors, the rebels, who had risen up against the American government in the name of protecting slave ownership, and they got a sound beating at Gettysburg. But also on the same day, they got another beating on the Mississippi River at the city of Vicksburg. I wanted to check in. I did not do so, but I'm aware of a problem in Vicksburg. They say that in Vicksburg they do not celebrate July 4th because for the city it supposedly is a great tragedy. That great tragedy would be the victory of the Union forces, which had 200,000 black soldiers. Amazing that perhaps a quarter of a million armed black Americans participated in the struggle to defeat slavery. Their army prevailed on the same date. You know, it might have been a couple of hours difference. These guys didn't have cell phones, but it was close. That two great victories were won against the Confederacy, which brings me to, I think you should all go see the film called The Free State of Jones, which is another element of the American Civil War, rarely remarked on. The Free State of Jones was established by black and white poor Americans who resisted the Confederacy in the county of Jones in the state of Mississippi during the Civil War. And they managed to develop a unity, a struggle against the Confederate government, which carried on over into the period of Reconstruction when the war ended. As you would expect, we're talking about Mississippi and we're talking about the United States. And the victories did not go on. They eventually ended tragically, with the crushing of Reconstruction. Reconstruction established the equality of black Americans. On paper, to do it in real life is where the battle is. But it's very significant that it was done. 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the American Constitution settled the matter that all those born in the United States were Americans, and you're not supposed to discriminate in any way, shape, or form. That's something which the white supremacists to this day do not accept. And to that extent, they're apparently not part of the United States, actually. They're some type of enemy of the American Constitution and the Bill of Rights. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I've already told you, I'm going to tell you again, go see the Free State of Jones. We're going to take a break and hear Mr. John Fogarty, and we'll come back with Thomas Mountain, we hope. And we're back. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, the host, and that was, of course, John Fogarty. Once upon a time, he was in an outfit called Credence and seemed appropriate. We're going to talk to Thomas C. Mountain, and I believe he's on the line now. Are you there, Thomas?
Yes. Hello, Torontonimo Bay.
Torontonimo. Okay. How you doing?
Oh, doing pretty good.
I'm glad to catch you. You are visiting Germany. Actually, I told everybody that you were traveling 110 miles an hour on the Autobahn. That's legal, huh?
Yeah, 180 kilometers an hour. I didn't even realize it until they started telling me. I said, oh, my God.
Yeah. It's best to know after you've done it.
Yeah.
By the way, were you actually driving or somebody else was doing it?
No, I was riding in the back seat.
Yeah, I would have been on the floorboard. Well, thanks, Thomas, for joining us. Of course, you live and work and do your writing primarily in Eritrea. But you attended an important conference in Germany of Eritreans. Why don't we start with that? What was that all about?
Well, this past weekend was the annual Eritrean Festival for the Eritreans in Germany, and they gathered in Gießen and, parties and talk politics and seminars, and it was like 24 hours of intensive Eritrean culture and politics. This is like an ongoing, they do one in Toronto every year, too. As a matter of fact, I think in a few weeks they'll be having a festival. Eritreans will be gathering in Toronto, Washington, D.C., Oakland, Stockholm, London, Amsterdam, Germany, Italy, Australia. Eritreans gather all over the world, and they have these festivals where they, get together and eat Eritrean food, and they have Eritrean singers come out from the country and tour the world, so we get the latest singers and the latest high-level government officials coming. And, they have seminars where anybody from the audience can get up and answer questions. It goes on for 2 or 3 hours at a time. Mm-hmm. But it's just like, people can ask anything they want. It's far-fetched to call Eritrea North Korea when the Eritrean government sends its senior officials out to stand up and take open questions from the audience. And when there's thousands of Eritreans gathered, they're doing it.
Yeah. And all over the world.
Yeah, and it's every summer. Mm-hmm. Eritrea, the United States and Eritrea have two things in common. Americans and Eritrean citizens have to pay an income tax. Now, Eritreans pay a 2% tax, and I can pay up to 30% to the American government on the income I have coming in. But, of course, if the Eritreans are collecting it, supporting terrorism. If the American government's collecting it, supporting democracy, right?
Yes.
So
that's what I've heard.
Yeah,
that's the gospel.
That's how it works.
All the parties here agree with that. Well, you yourself, did you give some speeches? I seem to recall that not so long ago, you did attend a meeting in Europe where you spoke.
There was a demonstration in Geneva on June 21st. Mm-hmm. Last year, a similar demonstration took place on June 22nd in Geneva. Both of them are against a committee of investigation that the UN Human Rights Commission convened. We call it, instead of the Committee of Investigation, the Committee of Instigation, instigating economic sabotage against Eritrea. Mm-hmm. The United States and their puppets at the UN have been trying to sabotage the funding for the next major upgrade in the Eritrean mining industry. Now, Eritrea's got a potash mine coming on. Potash is a fertilizer, which is potentially almost $1 billion a year coming into the country, of which something like 25 or 30 million a month will go into the Eritrean government's coffers to help fund projects like health care and education and water conservation and other things. And the United States desperately wants to stop this. Right now, Eritrea is in the middle of tying down about $760 million of investment capital to fund this potash mine. We know from WikiLeaks that back in 2009, the U.S. pushed through a resolution in the U.N. Security Council passing sanctions against Eritrea for allegedly supporting terrorism in Somalia in the shape of al-Shabaab. Mm-hmm. We know, again, thanks to WikiLeaks, that this is a complete fabrication and that the real purpose that the U.S. had was to block the financing for the very first mining operation in Eritrea, the Bisha Gold Mine, which is owned by a Canadian company called Nevsun. And they did actually successfully block the German banks financing the mine, but Nevsun very cleverly had a plan B and used the security market to get the necessary funding for the startup of the Eritrean mining industry, which is bringing in desperately needed foreign currency for the government to help upgrade the standard of living of the people. Mm-hmm. So this next major upgrade is the potash mine, and this is like a $760 million, three times a gold mine investment, and it's like a 15 or 20, maybe a 30-year mine, and it could end up bringing in as much as $30 billion, the country of Eritrea. And mm-hmm. the United States doesn't want that, because Eritrea is a socialist country like Cuba, mm-hmm. and to have Eritrea develop its economy and stand out as a role model for Africa, the United States says, no, we don't want that. So, mm-hmm. the problem is the United States is no longer in a position like it was in 2009 where they could ramrod a resolution against Eritrea and sanctions through this UN Security Council. Russia and China wouldn't allow them. So all they could do was set up a very noisy committee of instigation or investigation, as they call it, and make a lot of really outrageous charges against Eritrea. The charges were based entirely on anonymous interviews with so-called Eritrean refugees, 100% anonymous. So you couldn't verify any of it. And the charges were so outrageous that even such as the right-wing Atlantic Council and their African spokesman, Bronwyn Bruton, came out and basically said that it was such a Mickey Mouse investigation and report that if they were a college freshman, they would flunk based upon the research they did. Mm-hmm. And this is the right-wing Atlantic Council. So it was pretty blatant. All three of the so-called investigators, impartial investigators, had previously called for the overthrow, regime change in Eritrea, overthrow of the Eritrean government.
That must have been how they got the job, right? They vetted them. Are you for the overthrow of the Eritrean government? Yes.
Well, I think you could be an investigator. From the George Soros-funded Amnesty International, and at Amnesty, she called for regime change. And I published some documents that showed that Amnesty had secretly received a grant from the U.S. State Department to secretly send a delegation into Eritrea to try to carry out regime change. Amnesty getting a whistleblower at Amnesty International leaked a document and showed that Amnesty was actually taking money from the U.S. State Department to carry out regime change in Eritrea to try to destabilize the government. Of course, the Eritrean government stopped it in its tracks before it ever got started. But the documents are on the internet. I published them, and the likes of Amnesty are out there trying to, sort of like the fox guarding the chicken coop, right?
Yes. Well, I recall at the time of the bombing of Libya that an official from Human Rights Watch was attending meetings at the White House. And I don't understand why that wasn't game over for them. I mean, anybody with a sense of fair play and honesty and integrity and research, the moment you walk in the White House and you attend the meetings of the country that's bombing, it seems to me everybody ought to just say, no, that's like a yellow card or whatever it is. You're done.
Well, a number of Nobel Peace laureates signed an open letter raising questions about an Amnesty International official named Tom Malinowski, a longtime critic of Eritrea, who's gone back and forth between being a speechwriter for the Hillary Clinton campaign to Amnesty International. Mm-hmm. And so in any case, Amnesty International, for Human Rights Watch.
Yes.
And Human Rights Watch, of course, has received hundreds of millions of dollars from George Soros. And George Soros has been involved in everything from the Rose Revolution, the Orange Revolution, to even he supported the Ukrainian coup. So George, he's one of the 1%, and he's got his media empire and his political empire. But in any case, we have nothing but problems here in Eritrea with the so-called human rights mob, I think I've called them in the past, where they're mobbed up with 1% money, and they're out doing the bidding and spreading a lot of nasty lies and slanders. I tell people, don't believe anything you read and almost nothing you see about Eritrea. I mean, the best place to check is the Phil Taylor Report. They'll get the real skinny here.
Well, that's because we do rely upon Thomas Mountain. Just, by the way, it's Thomas C. Mountain on Facebook, where a lot of this material that Thomas is referring to is available. And, of course, you can always find also just Google Thomas C. Mountain, and you'll come up with all the background. Thomas, there were skirmishes recently with the Ethiopian army. Can you tell us what that was? That occurred in mid-June, did it not?
Right, June 12th, just before I came up for the demonstrations.
And it wasn't reported here, by the way. Here there was silence on the subject.
Yeah, well, in the last 3 months, the U.S. government, in support of the Eritrean government, the Ethiopian regime, has been backing a massive military buildup on the Ethiopian border with Eritrea. Mm-hmm. And this includes hundreds of millions of dollars of state-of-the-art equipment from the U.S. African Command that's been building up on the Ethiopian border with Eritrea for 3 months now. And, there's a lot of talk about the U.S. African Command, this and that, and not a word from many of our left-wing friends about the African Command's buildup on the Eritrean border. On June 12th, the Ethiopian army attacked Eritrea in an area called Sorona, and they came across the border, and the Eritreans ended up pretty much snuffing them out. They all came, a lot of thousands of them came, and none of them returned. But, you know, it was a major attack. The fighting lasted for 30 hours, and, you know, a couple thousand Ethiopians got either killed or wounded or captured. You know, and this is the prelude of what's to come. The American government is putting pressure on Eritrea, not only economically, but militarily. Of course, see, the thing is, the Ethiopian regime is on its last legs. I mean, the Ethiopian people are really fed up with the Ethiopian regime. There's this huge famine raging, 10 million people starving to death, and yet Ethiopia is doing a military buildup on the Eritrean border and wants to start a war with Eritrea. I mean, it's like Eritrea's got 5 million people. Ethiopia's got 90 million people, the largest, best-equipped army in Africa. And now the U.S. African Command is prepositioning all of this modern weaponry on the Ethiopian border with Eritrea. And not a word in the Western press except when they say, you know, well, the Eritrean government claims. You know, yes. The Ethiopian opposition has been reporting large, massive movements of heavy equipment and heavy weaponry up into northern Ethiopia to the border with Eritrea. So, you know, this threat of war is increasing and out of desperation because the Ethiopian regime is facing massive uprisings, political uprisings across the country, along with this huge drought with literally hundreds of people dying every day in Ethiopia from starvation, as I speak to you. Yeah. Hundreds of people dying a day, and yet where's the outrage in the world that Ethiopia is about to launch a war against Eritrea? And so, you know, this war is for Ethiopia, in a sense, to divert their internal opposition to the regime and try to rally the nationalist forces to say, oh, we have to fight our evil neighbors, Eritrea, this small country of 5 million on the northern border. And, you know, patriotism is the last resort of scoundrels, right? I mean, historically so. There's nationalism, and you know, but the Ethiopian government is in serious problems. And now that the largest part of Ethiopia, the largest ethnic group, the Oromos, make up 40% of the country. They're actually the second largest nationality in Africa with 40 million people or so, are fed up. And they've woken up from their long slumber and their spontaneous outbreaks of protest across the Oromia. There's, you know, major opposition now to the Ethiopian government. People are fed up. They can't feed their own people. They've been borrowing or getting investment of something like $11 billion a year. And yet, tens of you know, millions and millions of people are starving.
And Mr. Soros isn't terribly interested in that subject.
Right. We've seen the thing is, you know, since the economic crash in 2008, there's been a major shift in the world economics. The Asia and North America used to be the major trading partners. Now it's Asia and Europe are the major economic trading partners. And almost all of that trade goes through the Red Sea, through the Horn of Africa. There are two strategic choke points, the Suez Canal, which the U.S. pays $1.5 billion a year to the Egyptian army to protect. And then there's the Baab al-Mandeb, the Gate of Tears between the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, with Eritrea on one side and Yemen on the other. Well, you know, guess what? The United States is providing cluster bombs and high-tech targeting for targets in Yemen for the Saudi occupation army in Yemen to, you know, to keep anybody that's not directly under the thumb of the U.S. from power. And, you know, now they're threatening Eritrea with a war to try to get Eritrea to, you know, to deal down and accept U.S. hegemony in the region so the U.S. can maintain their economic control of these strategic trading partners, Asia and Europe. So, you know, there's a lot of geopolitics and critical strategic interest in the United States and the region. And Eritrea is, like I say, on one side of the Red Sea, and the Yemen's on the other, and you've already got the U.S. heavily involved in a war in Yemen.
That's a war that we hear nothing about. Yes, and this is Thomas C. Mountain. Yes, there's an interesting parallel. You're quite right. The Ethiopia aggression against Eritrea is not noted here at all, and certainly the fighting in Yemen, which is nakedly an aggression by Saudi Arabia with arms being supplied by the British government and the American government. Heavy casualties. It's a poorest country being attacked by the richest. And yet, hardly any discussion. But
and you know,
you're adjacent. You're across the Red Sea from them.
And U.S. African Command has been part of a three-month buildup of strategic weapons, heavy weapons, the latest technology by the U.S. on the Eritrean border. And this is completely, you know, I mean, I just, you read all these so-called experts on the Horn of Africa, and none of them has got a clue that this huge buildup is taking place, and that we've already, a 30-hour battle has been launched, and the United States is pre-positioning all this weaponry on the Eritrean border.
Mm-hmm.
And, when it comes to the Horn of Africa, it's like we're off in the corner. You know, I mean, in 2010, 2012, the UNICEF and the UN oversaw the starvation deaths of 250,000 Somalis. And, I mean, I predicted this. I think I even talked about this on your show.
Yes.
They only budgeted 10 cents a day to feed a million Somali refugees under the UN control. And I said, you know, they're going to starve on 10 cents a day, and they did. A 250,000 Somalis starved to death in 2 years in Somalia proper while they were supposed to be the responsibility of the UN. And, you know, none of this is raised, and nobody even blinked in the West when a 250,000 Somalis starved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yet now we've got 10 million Ethiopians starving, hundreds of Ethiopians dying of starvation every day, and the Ethiopians and the U.S. are building up troops on the Eritrean border and threatening to attack Eritrea. Now, the Somalis are starving because there was another drought. We have climate disaster hammering the Horn of Africa. As the polar ice caps melt, the polar sea ice melts, and the sea starts absorbing water, I mean heat from the sun instead of reflecting it from the ice, the warm air floats out over Greenland ice caps, and the Greenland ice caps start to melt, and the fresh water floods in. You know, we start seeing major climate change, and it first hammers the equatorial region. So the things that are happening up in the Arctic are first felt in the Horn of Africa. And Eritrea and the Horn of Africa has been getting hammered by record-breaking droughts. Eritrea, where I live, has had droughts the six in the last 12 years. We had a two-year drought, never before in history, 2003-2004. Again, another two-year drought in 2008-2009, a drought in 2013. And this Horn of Africa drought, 2015, which is, you know, we're hearing about Ethiopia starving, it hit Eritrea as well. But you know what? Eritrea, we're a dictatorship, so nobody's starving.
Yeah.
You know, in Ethiopia, they're a democracy. Of course, a democracy where 100% of the
you have a right
members
to starve.
Of parliament were elected from the ruling party, right?
Yeah.
In Eritrea, we don't have elections, but our government feeds our people.
Yeah.
And they're doing it because the Eritrean government is very conscious of climate change. There's been these massive water conservations, huge reservoirs that are being built with what limited money Eritrea has. They store the water, and they use it to irrigate. So no Eritreans starving, and yet 10 million Ethiopians are starving. And Ethiopians, you know, Obama was there at the AU meeting last year, and what did he say? Oh, Ethiopians, 100% democracy. Of course, they were at 100% of their parliament was all from the ruling party. So, you know, of course, Eritrea is being condemned for so-called human rights violations, while, you know, Ethiopia is being praised as a democracy. Well, when we speak of human rights, what do we speak of? The first most important human right is the right to food, enough food to survive. The second is the right to drinking water. The third, to a roof over your head. The fourth, to medical care. And the fifth, for education for your children. If you're providing these to your country, then you're providing the basic human rights of the people. And way down the list, there's freedom of speech and freedom of the press and elections and all this stuff. Well, Ethiopia, 10 million people are starving. You know, the people don't have water. They don't have food. They don't have medical care. They don't have education. And yet they're a democracy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, and then they are attacking Eritrea because Eritrea is supporting terrorism or something like that. You know, I mean, it's like everything is twisted upside down.
Well, I mean, we have Saudi Arabia, where the United Nations said, oh, they're, you know, they have attacked children in Yemen, and they've done terrible things. And when the report comes out, Ban Ki-moon says, well, we're going to withdraw that.
and then his reason is he says money to us if we publish that report. So yeah, I know.
And then his reason for that is he said, well, you know, they contribute to one of our programs, and therefore I can't say the truth. Well, I mean, then why not fold your tent and go home? I mean, that you're going to allow the Saudis to dictate, and they don't, by the way, play around with the words like democracy. They're an absolute monarchy. They do what they want.
And, you know, Ethiopia invaded Eritrea in 2000. The Eritreans managed to defeat the invasion, and they signed a final, so-called final and binding peace treaty and with a border demarcation in 2002, and Ethiopia has refused to accept the final and binding demarcation, which the UN and Ban Ki-moon and everybody else has promised to enforce, and the United States and the EU, and they haven't enforced it. Instead, we find Ethiopia continuing to operate, occupy Eritrea and sovereign territory. And now we have Ethiopia attacking Eritrea and the U.S. building up major arms, modern arms along the Eritrean border, threatening Eritrea. In early February of 2015, a U.S. missile, it had to have been a U.S. missile, was used to strike an arms depot in the Eritrean town of Dekomhati. Mm-hmm. Now, Ethiopia doesn't possess any of these missiles. Maybe it was fired from a U.S. drone. But, you know, we already know that some pretty high-tech stuff is already in the hands of the Ethiopians. And now, you know, we're getting reports of major arms buildup on the border from the Ethiopian opposition and the Eritrean government. And so the threat of war is looming, and yet the silence of the international community on this matter, I mean, how can they sit back and say it's okay for Ethiopia to attack Eritrea when there are 10 million Ethiopians starving, at least 10 million, hundreds are dying every day, and it's okay for Ethiopia to launch a war against Eritrea?
Apparently, that's it's a shocking fact that they can get away with this. We're talking to Thomas C. Mountain, by the way. You can find him on Facebook, and of course, you just put in Thomas C. Mountain, you get all the writing of Thomas. And I want to ask you about these other players. Now, Djibouti was one of the three that brought the charges, right? It was Djibouti and Somalia and Ethiopia that signed something.
Yeah.
Now, but does either of those governments actually exist? I mean, you were talking about Ethiopia's government's lack of legitimacy, but Djibouti has always been a mystery to the world. And I wish, let's remind everybody, that is the greatest port in the Horn of Africa, in that region. They have got, and that is to say the French and Americans, because it's always been under European power, that port.
Well, the interesting thing is the Chinese are now building their first foreign military base.
That's going to be fun.
In Djibouti. And they've actually, the Djiboutian government kicked Americans out of a small military base they occupied outside of Djibouti city proper, and now the Chinese are bringing something like 10,000 soldiers there. And this is at the choke point, the Baab al-Mandeb. Now, Djibouti is a small little country of 500,000 people.
Have those troops
born in
disembarked?
Ethiopia.
I'm sorry, Thomas. I just wanted a footnote. I recall we did an interview about this, but have the Chinese begun to disembark? I mean, actually have troops?
Yeah, they've actually started now.
On the ground there?
Yeah, they're on the ground and they're expanding.
It must be a big story because we never hear about it.
Well, you know, and the thing is, this is I wrote a story called U.S. versus China in Djibouti, because this is a major threat. I mean, just a few miles away from the Americans' Camp Lemonnier, which is the headquarters for their drone program and their strategic interest for the African command in the Horn of Africa and in East Africa in general. And now the Chinese are putting a base right within a few miles of this very strategic U.S. base. So now you're hearing in the American Congress all of a sudden, oh, the Djiboutian president is a dictator and he's against human rights, and we might have to replace him to protect the Djibouti people. Half a billion. Djibouti's a reality. It's a province of Ethiopia. It always has been. But the French are there, the Americans are there, and now the Chinese are there. It's like things are heating up in the Horn of Africa. The Chinese are supposed to be putting a $400 million port expansion in Djibouti, so things are getting pretty heated up there.
Yeah. Historically, in colonial terms, it was the French who ran Djibouti, right?
Right.
It's Thomas E. Mountain. And Somalia, who are they to bring these charges in? What's the role of these three countries towards Eritrea?
Well, Somalia is, it's a long, complicated story, but there's something like 25,000 foreign peacekeepers in Somalia that are, and the Somali government is completely dependent on foreign aid and these basically European, U.S.-funded UN so-called peacekeepers from countries, bastions of democracy like Uganda and, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, you've got...
There's Somali money to be government. Made in that, right? A lot of those countries, that's where they send soldiers and they get cash.
Well, you know, and then their generals steal their salaries, so the soldiers end up selling their weapons on the black market. Who buys it? The Al-Shabaab terrorists that they accuse Eritrea of supporting and providing arms to, which is, we know from WikiLeaks, is a lie. And that instead their arms are actually being, they're getting their arms from buying them black market for cash from the very UN peacekeepers that are supposed to be fighting Al-Shabaab. So Somalia is a mess. The government there is completely dependent on foreign aid and foreign troops to keep it in power. And so, you know, when the master whistles, they have to dance for their money, and that's what they've done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the legitimacy of these governments, and they're, you know, claiming that Eritrea is this and Eritrea is that. It's, you know, it's like the pot calling the kettle black, and it's pretty ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the so-called African institutions? The OAS or AU is still in Addis Ababa, right?
Yes, you know, the African Union is, again, they were also a guarantee to see that the Ethiopia would implement their final and binding peace agreement, border demarcation of the Eritrea, and they've completely failed to do so. You know, they're in Addis Ababa. A couple of years ago, there was the Ethiopian government tried to take over the Muslim community in Ethiopia, which is actually majority of them. People don't realize that Ethiopia is actually majority Muslim. Mm-hmm. And the Muslim religious community was faced with the Ethiopian government demanding that they appoint the leaders of their community, the people that were provided by the Ethiopian regime. And the Muslims said no. And historically, the Muslims in Ethiopia have been very apolitical. Mm-hmm. Even back when Mengistu and the Haile Selassie and the big famines of the 1980s, when these big repressive regimes and the civil wars that were going on, the Muslim community never was political. But since the Ethiopian regime came in and tried to take over the Muslim community, the religious institutions in Ethiopia, there was resistance. There was protest. The regime fired on the protest, murdered people, came in and attacked people worshiping in the mosque. And we're talking about 50 or more million people here representing the Muslim community in Ethiopia. And the Ethiopian Muslim community is now becoming revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And it's the only organization in Ethiopia that has a national presence and an infrastructure, you know, churches, Muslim mosques and religious madrasas, religious schools, and they're all across the country. They represent the majority of the population, and they're becoming revolutionary. In some ways, like what happened in Iran, was mm-hmm. the only place that the revolutionaries against the Shah could gather and talk politics was mm-hmm. in the mosques. The same thing's happening in Ethiopia now. So we may very well see a popular uprising against the Ethiopian government that ends up being led by the religious Islamic community in Ethiopia. But these aren't religious fanatics. The Ethiopian Muslim community are led by a very moderate Sunni leadership that's gotten along very well for centuries with a Christian community there. Mm-hmm. And it's just like in Eritrea, they get along, they don't want to fight, they reject all this Salafi and Wahhabism. And mm-hmm. they would like to see a country that where religious communities live in peace and harmony, mm-hmm. which is being broken by the Ethiopian regime, the present regime, which is trying to get the various national groups and the ethnic groups and the religious groups to fight each other so that they can divide and conquer. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of people would be interested to think that, you know, hey, we may see a revolutionary Islam come to the fore in Ethiopia and overthrow the government, help play a leadership role in overthrowing the government. Because they're actually the only national presence in the whole country. You know, there are ethnic leaders groups that are fighting against the government, but they're just within their own ethnicity. There's no real national organization that can lead this uprising. And it may very well be the Ethiopian Muslim community that does so, something I think people ought to seriously start to watch out for.
I'm really glad to hear you talking about this. That's something that we've had noted a couple of our interviews in the past with individuals have told us this, and again, these things just don't make the radar here. But have they begun to pronounce themselves on the issue of conflict with Eritrea?
Well, the whole entire Ethiopian opposition movement has formed two coalitions. One coalition made up of the Amhara and the Tigrayan, which are mainly Christians, but do have a sizable Muslim community, that have formed an organization that basically based upon democracy and justice in Ethiopia. And then there's another organization comprising the Oromos, the Somalis and the Ogaden, the Bangul, the Sidama, and the people in Gambela in the west. that are talking about self-determination. In other words, they're talking about independence. Mm-hmm. So there's two of these movements. They have formed a basic organizations or congresses working together, and both these organizations are based in Eritrea. So the leadership of the entire Ethiopian opposition is very aware of the fact that Eritrea has the best interest of Ethiopian people in mind. We want peace with our neighbor in Ethiopia. We want a peaceful Ethiopia mm-hmm. where the people can live in peace and harmony, and the whole Horn of Africa can benefit instead of having this warlike regime that invaded Eritrea in 2000, invaded Somalia in 2006, and is now carrying threatening Eritrea with another war while can't even manage to feed its own people with 10 million people starving. So the Ethiopian people are fed up with the regime. They don't want to go fight with Eritrea. Eritrea doesn't want to fight with Ethiopia. They see it's all in all of our interests to live in peace and harmony together. And the only problem is the Ethiopian regime, which is being backed by like $11 billion in aid and investment every year, primarily from the West, yes. as well as the United States. So, Ethiopian people are fed up. They want to see a change. They don't see Eritrea as their enemy. As a matter of fact, Eritrea is a haven for their leadership of the opposition to the regime. So, they can, from there, they can organize and go out into their communities and say, look, what is it going to take to get rid of this regime, to start feeding our people, start providing our people with education and medical care, and, to prevent these huge, massive famines that are happening as a result of climate disaster, which, by the way, is primarily the result of industrialization by mainly Western countries that we're getting hammered with out here. Mm-hmm. And so, but there's something that I would like to raise with your listeners a little bit, and this is because we in the Horn of Africa are already at the very front lines of climate disaster. And, people talk a lot about carbon dioxide. What the scientific community is just starting to talk about is something called methane. And at the permafrost, you hear stories about the houses built in Alaska sinking into the melting permafrost. The permafrost and the bottom of the Arctic Ocean contains methane hydrate. Something like a trillion tons of methane is stored in the permafrost, and methane is 10 times worse for global warming than carbon dioxide. And lo and behold, methane is bubbling off from last summer on the coast of Siberia and the Arctic Ocean, temperatures reached 40 centigrade for 3 days in a row. This is the land of the permafrost, and it's 400 and something degrees in Siberia. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is this is melting, putting heat into the ocean. And the water is quite shallow along the Arctic shelf, and the methane hydrates on the floor are melting, and the NASA satellites are seeing, international satellites are seeing big plumes of methane bubbling up, and this methane is getting into the atmosphere, and it's going to heat up the atmosphere very fast. Now, 10 years ago, the climate scientists were saying, okay, the polar sea ice was going to melt in 100 years, okay? We're 10 years later, and they're saying, oh, this year all the polar sea ice may be melted. Not in 100 years, in 10 years. Hmm. Okay, so this climate disaster is speeding up, and no one's even talking about methane, which is going to, we could see a catastrophic release of methane in the next 15 or 20 years. Melting, if you just melt the ice on Greenland, you're talking about a 23-meter rise in the ocean level. Hmm. And they're saying, that today the climate scientists are saying, in 100 years, the sea levels might rise a meter. Well, 10 years ago, they were saying the polar ice was going to melt in 100 years, and now it's all melted. Mm-hmm. So if in 10 years from now, instead of 100 years from now, what if we see this 1 meter rise in sea levels? Well, it's going to affect the whole planet. And in the first place it's going to hammer is going to be along the equator. We're going to see huge droughts and maybe 5 or 10 year droughts in the Horn of Africa, massive starvation. And as the sea levels start to rise, of course, a lot of cities are going to get hammered. But, it's going to hammer us here in the Horn as well. So, what's going on now, we're seeing the forerunners of what's eventually going to catch up with the whole world hammering us in the Horn. And, that this drought in Ethiopia is no coincidence, this famine that we're seeing. So, a lot of people don't know that the scientists are very quietly, very worried about this methane problem. It's no longer carbon dioxide. So methane is something, it's going to be released. We really can't do anything about it, releasing it, because we've passed that point. So, it's kind of alarmist. It's kind of scary. It's almost kind of science fiction. But, It's something that we're already facing in the Horn with these increasing droughts. I mean,
let me ask you about that, Thomas. If this being the case, is the Eritrean government and others discussing this? I mean, if it's if the Horn is the one where it's most evident, is there good available information about this?
Well, you know, the Eritrean president's really far-sighted guy. I mean, for the last couple of years, he's been spending a great deal of time out in the countryside overseeing construction of massive water reservoirs. Now, you have droughts, but there is some rain that still falls. And it's mm-hmm. Not enough to grow food, but you catch all that water, you can use that water to irrigate. And you mm-hmm. can grow food with irrigation. You don't have to depend on this rainfall irrigation. Then you can survive. And that's what Eritrea's been doing. We got hammered with the same drought in 2015 as Ethiopia does. But nobody's starving in Eritrea.
Mm-hmm.
Because why? Because the government takes care of its people. We're a socialist government. And the government sees that, instead of everybody having an Xbox and a smartphone, maybe we should be out there building a water reservoirs with what money we have and making sure that everybody has something to eat.
Yeah.
And,
it is interesting. Fidel, in his recent, he's quite old now, but he's made this his focus. He talks a lot about climate change. And when he's been contributing essays about it, it's clear it's on his mind. It's interesting,
Noam Chomsky talked about this problem with the Greenland ice. One of the major ice fields in Greenland now has basically got a layer of water underneath and has broken free of the ground, which means it's going to be melting at an alarming rate. And anybody that's following what's going on in the environment, anybody with any political consciousness is starting to read reports now. You can read them on Counterpunch about the scientists worried about these methane. It's got everybody, the scientists are really, they're talking about a climate emergency has got to be declared immediately
mm-hmm.
and, start preparing. And yet, what are we doing? We're seeing the United States supplying cluster bombs to Saudi and putting weapons on the Eritrean border. And, maybe they want to fight with the Soviet Union and start putting missiles on fight with Russia and putting missiles on Russian border.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's like in Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, you think these guys are going to do anything about this? And, the reality is, the scientists who have to be very conservative because if they're too alarmist, they won't get funding, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in spite of that, the scientists are coming out and all the leading journals in this field are saying climate emergency, and not because of carbon dioxide, because of methane, which is 10 times worse for global warming and trapping the heat on the planet than carbon dioxide. And we're talking about a trillion tons of methane in the permafrost up there in Canada, right?
Yes.
And under the Arctic Sea. So, Toronto, you guys are along a waterway, right? If the water levels rise a meter or two in 10 years, what's going to happen to Toronto?
Now you've got us alone.
You've mentioned us.
It's always a problem. The excitement begins when you mention somebody local. You're right. Of course, it is a great. The lakes are warming, which has everybody concerned. We go through a winter and they say, gee, the lakes didn't freeze. And they say, that's funny. I don't remember that happening. Yes. I have to say to you, the methane point, I have, hearing you talk about it, registers it more with me. Unfortunately, we have our authorities divided, so we rarely mix politics and those talking about the environment and the question of the footprint of the carbon dioxide. And methane, by your account, is clearly more now much more dangerous. People can think about it. I want to understand methane is much more lethal.
Yeah, I've been sitting around here kind of freestyling with my nephew here, Richard nephew, and, because I've been taking a hard look and realizing, I read Noam Chomsky recently, and he's talking about this problem. I mean, I'm reading everybody from Ron Jacobs and Counterpunch and all these longtime political activists that are mainly political have all started to look at the future of the planet and saying, geez, what are we facing here now? We're talking about elections, we're talking about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, and yet there are massive methane plumes bubbling up out of the seabeds in the Arctic Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And if this stuff, when this stuff gets unleashed, we're going to see, temperatures go up in 120, 130, 140.
Mm-hmm.
If carbon dioxide levels, because methane is basically our hydrocarbon, right? carbon dioxide levels start building up along the coastal areas because these are heavy gases, right? And, you know, if right now, 100 years ago, carbon dioxide was at 250 parts per million. Now it's up to 400 parts per million. Everybody's excited about it. Well, methane's going to, you know, skyrocket in terms of what these buildups are going to be. You know, at certain points, when we start seeing carbon dioxide and hydrocarbon levels build up to 800 parts per million, people aren't going to be able to live in these conditions. Mm-hmm. You can't, you know, you can take about 700-800 parts per million, you start getting sick of carbon dioxide. And we're already at 400, and we're talking about a trillion tons being released. So the low-lying coastal areas may become uninhabitable. People may actually have to use these rebreathers that filter the carbon dioxide out of the air and may have to live in enclosed environments where the carbon dioxide is scrubbed out of the air. You know, I mean, these are scary ideas, but then on the other hand, like I'm myself involved in a sustainable fishing project in Eritrea where we're looking at developing aquaculture that's based upon collecting algae. Now, we hear a lot about algae blooms in the world, in the seas, and they wipe out all the oxygen. And algae blooms are a direct result of the carbon gas buildup in the water because algae is a part of photosynthesis, eats carbon dioxide, okay? Well, on the other hand, it can damage the ocean, but on the other hand, we can actually feed the oceans with algae and phytoplankton and use that to soak up the carbon dioxide, harvest that phytoplankton and algae, and use it to feed fish like milkfish and mullet and provide a quality protein source for our population. Now, these fish can be grown in pens that are floating as the oceans rise. You know, I mean, these are sort of ideas people have got to start thinking about and start, you know, saying, oh, we can inject carbon dioxide into the seas. This stuff's not going to work. We're going to have to look at some way of one, reducing the acidity levels in the ocean and soaking up carbon dioxide, but using that algae as food. That's algae not just for humans, but we can grow fish with that algae.
Yes.
And, you know, so these are areas that people got to look at. We're looking at that here in Eritrea, and we're saying, look, you know, we can develop aquaculture in our coastal waters and grow milkfish and mullet and, you know, use the increasing levels of algae in our waters to feed these fish. And, you know, the fish, by eating the algae traps the carbon dioxide. I mean, this is just like the beginnings of what's going to happen internationally so that we can start reducing the carbon and hydrocarbon to methane levels. You know, it's going to take a long time to do, but it's something that people haven't even considered. Everybody's lost in this Disneyland of their Xboxes and their smartphones and their Facebook and you know.
Well, also an economy run by financiers and corporations who first of all, want to know how they're going to make any money off something. You're talking about, you're speaking of a course of.
The scientists that know about it are saying we need to declare a climate emergency. Now, we in the Horn of Africa have been dealing with climate disasters and climate emergencies going back some 15, 16 years now because we have no choice. It's not something, it's not like the day after tomorrow and a film. This is reality of people, millions of people are starving, and if we don't deal with this, if we don't start putting our scarce resources into water conservation and forestation and soil conservation and start irrigating our crops and growing enough food to feed our population, our people are going to starve. This isn't something that's hit the people in the northern part of the hemisphere yet, but it is going to start hitting you guys. And, you know, the fact is that what we're doing now is something you guys should be watching because we're facing climate disaster that hasn't started to hammer you guys yet because we're down here by the equator.
Yes.
So, you know, when people talk about Eritrean president's a dictator, da-da-da-da, no, man, God, this guy is outside work in the field, spending weeks at a time overseeing construction of water reservoirs, and now we've got food to eat.
Yeah.
So he's looking very far-sighted because droughts have been 1 year, 2 years. It could be 5 years. They could be 10 years. Can you imagine what happened in Canada if you had a drought that lasted 10 years and all the agriculture in the whole country failed?
Yeah. Well,
you know, and this is what you're going to be facing.
You'd see a lot of movement of people.
We're talking politics, but we can't avoid the climate disaster.
Absolutely. This is Thomas C. Mountain, by the way, Facebook, Thomas C. Mountain, and you can find the writings and underlining all the issues he's addressing just now. Of course, Thomas, you're mentioning this. In order to use the word we, that's where societies run into a problem. Who are we? Because we increasingly, we're dominated, as you're quite well aware, that by states which say the people who should decide are the bankers, the corporations, And we just witnessed the reaction to the British vote. They say, well, these masses, they're getting in the way. They don't know what's good for them. And but, you know, if you don't consult everybody and you don't have a common community plan, such things as the environmental disasters you speak of simply be divided according to which class you belong to, and the 1% and the others can go to blazes.
Well, you know, there's a lot of Eritreans in Canada, and they pay their
We'll organize them. We'll start with them.
And this income tax is what's being used to build the major source of funding for this water conservation that's feeding the population. And the Canadian government is doing everything in its power to prevent the Eritrean people in Canada from contributing to the Eritrean government to prevent climate disaster. And yet the Canadian government is trying to prevent all of this. Mm-hmm. And the same thing in the United States and in Sweden and in UK and other countries. They're all saying, oh, this is money's being collected to fund terrorism. No, it's not. It's going to develop economic food security so that our people don't starve. Mm-hmm. And yet instead of, you know, come out and condemning the aggression of Ethiopia against Eritrea, they're trying to prevent the Eritrean government from getting money to be able to build water reservoirs to feed our people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so something right in Canada that the Canadian government is doing. The Canadian people need to speak out about this and stop saying, oh, this is using to support terrorism. That's a lie. Yeah, that's a lie. That's
of
all,
course,
it's
patently not the case. And by the way, it's quite well known that Saudi Arabia, who's presently bombing Yemen, is the ideological and financial center for the worst terrorists that are functioning anywhere in the world. Eritrea doesn't make the cut. I don't even know how anybody paste together as such accusations.
Yeah, you know that's another story, another interview. I wrote an article entitled "Yemen, Saudi Arabia's Vietnam," which is turning out to be that way. But you know the fact is that it's sort of like people live in like a Disneyland. They think that things are okay, that we're not faced with this big crisis. You know, that people go around their lives thinking like we can't do anything about it. And the reality is if they don't do anything about it, what's happening to us now in the Horn of Africa, which we're having to deal with, is going to catch up to you guys up in the north. And,
yes.
You know, you can see the beginnings of it all, but it's eventually what's happening to us is going to catch up to you too.
Yeah, well, indeed. And well, I think, Thomas, you'd probably agree that as the crisis deepens, we'll see more Disneylands. Because to use the oldest cliche of all, the bread and circuses, right? As you get into problems.
Yeah, everybody's got Netflix now, right? You can sit home and binge out on movies. And
yeah,
don't
look out the window. We've got a great movie for you.
Yeah, matter of fact, my nephew just did a pitch to a movie maker with some of these ideas I'm talking about tonight. Say, look, this isn't some fantasy day after tomorrow. This is something that... It's just like all of a sudden it's dawning on the world. We've got this huge methane problem, and the scientists are all saying it's a huge problem, and no one's listening to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've been so fortunate to talk to Thomas C. Mountain. I should give you a chance. Is there a last point you want to make? What are you telling all the Eritreans they should think about around the world?
Well, a point I want to make is that, look, there's very few places like the Taylor Report that people can get this kind of information. So your listeners out there got to dig deep and financially contribute to the Taylor Report, because otherwise, how is this truth going to get out? But you know, all you people out there sitting stuck in your cars in the rush hour listening to the Taylor Report, get home, man. Find a way to contribute 10, 15, 20 bucks. At least the truth will get out. Okay, Phil?
Hey, well, I appreciate that. And I'm going to call you when we're raising funds, too.
Okay.
Thomas, thank you very much. We'll talk to you again soon. Okay,
yeah.
Bye-bye. Thomas C. Mountain, very popular gentleman. Whenever Thomas is on, we always get a lot of interesting comments. As I said, listening to the Taylor Report, I do have one announcement before we close here. On July 14, Ken Stone is going to be speaking at Betsatoon, and you all know Betsatoon. And he made a trip to Syria. He actually went to Palmyra, which I think everybody should want to hear an eyewitness account of that, the liberated city of Palmyra, which is a World Heritage Site. It was a dramatic moment this past spring. Anyway, that'll be July 14 at 7 o'clock. It's called Defiant Syria, a personal dispatches, and that's Ken Stone. And you have been listening to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I want to thank Ken and all the others, Eric, who looked after us today. See you next week.